Good afternoon, everybody. We will get started with this afternoon's program. First of all, I would like to welcome you to the Boston Public Library. My name is David Leonard. I am the new president here, and it is really exciting to have the Boston Book Festival back at the Boston Public Library. As you may have seen on your way in, we've been a little busy with the building for the last 2 years, so it's exciting to have this newly renovated space and to have the Boston Book Festival be one of the signature events to kick off the season. I would, however, be remiss if I did not also mention that we last night opened the Shakespeare exhibition, Shakespeare Unauthorized, which is over in the McKim Building. And that is an exhibition that has many items in it, including the first folios. So if you bear with me, you may consider that William Shakespeare was his own diagnostician at the time 400 years ago, looking at, you know, politics, family dynamics, history, perhaps the way things worked then. Whereas today, 400 years later, our speaker today, David Macaulay, is known for many works, cathedral, city, castle, mosque, and has with humor and precision depicted everything from buildings to machines to the human body. His worldwide bestseller, The Way Things Work, has now been updated to include machines of our modern era, like 3D printers, touchscreens, and Wi-Fi, all things you now find around us here at the Boston Public Library, too. If I may quote from the Boston Globe, its review of the original edition, The Way Things Work, "It's not only the book that has tried to explain modern mysteries, but it's the best. Macaulay's explanations are lucid, they are fun, he includes visual puns, running jokes, a cast of thousands of tiny participants in, on, and around the machines, choirs of angels, and lots of big woolly mammoths." Aside perhaps from the mammoths, that sounds vaguely Shakespearean to me too. So we look forward to hearing a little bit from David in a moment. Michael Hawley is the director of special projects and founder of MIT's Go Expeditions program, and has been on the faculty of MIT for nearly a decade, working on a wide array of creative projects with students in electrical engineering and in the Media Lab, where he held the Alex Dreyfus professorship. Hawley is the co-founder of Things That Think, founder of Toys of Tomorrow, and Counterintelligence, all of which function to explore the limitless ways that digital media can infuse everyday objects. He is also founder of the nonprofit Friendly Planet, which is dedicated to children's education in developing countries. So please join me in welcoming to the stage Michael Hawley and David Macaulay to help us explain, investigate the way our civically connected, yet sometimes disconnected world works. Welcome to your library, the place where storytelling happens. Michael and David, thank you.
Thanks. I'm going to stand up for this part. Thanks. Three little bits of a housekeeping nature. First, I'm not currently at MIT. I spent 20 years there that went by in a flash. Leaving MIT is sort of like leaving the mafia. You never really get out. So it'll always be a part of me, and I'll always be a part of it. But I'm not an active professor. The second two bits are of a real housekeeping nature. First, after our hour, David's books are on the shelf just outside of the theater. Book signing, schmoozing, this is your opportunity to get a signed copy. The second thing is, there's a raffle, I understand, being held this year. You can win a Vespa scooter, and volunteers are wearing black Vespa t-shirts. They'll get you little raffle tickets, so be sure to find one of them after the session if you want to get a scooter. I want to tell you briefly how I met David, and this is not the slide I need. I thought there were a set of about 8 or 10 introductory slides, guys. They involve pictures of Bhutan and a project that David and I worked on together. Can you please pull those up? Please, you know, bear with us. By the way, I would say that if you guys are half as thrilled as I am to be here today with David, this is going to be a fantastic hour. And believe me, I'll get out of the way as soon as they put up a few pictures that we carefully sent in advance.
This is the way things work, you know.
Or the way don't. Well, let me try to tell you the way we met, and hopefully they'll find the damn slides. Once upon a time, when I was still at MIT, I embarked on a strange project. We did an educational photography project in a tiny kingdom called Bhutan, nestled in the Himalayas, the last Shangri-La. After the smoke had cleared, we'd shot about 100,000 photographs with students in Bhutan. The kids took about half of the pictures. But we couldn't find any publisher willing to take on the project, a nice photo book about Bhutan. And I've got, if one of our assistants could run into the green room and grab my red bag, red and black leather bag, there's a copy of the small Bhutan book there. Thank you, Natalie. And I'll show you the picture that way if we can't put it up on the screen. The result of the work was a gigantic book. It's a little hard to describe without the pictures, but it was the largest book ever produced. It's 5 feet tall, 7 feet wide, stands on an easel, and the pictures of people are life-sized. You flip a page and you're kind of in a different world. Well, I had shown this book at a small meeting in Philadelphia, had a prototype copy on the stage, and after I sat down, the guy next to me sort of elbowed me, and he said, "Hey, that's a really big book." And I said, "Yeah, it might be the biggest book ever." And he said, "Tell me, does that book come with a dust jacket?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, a really big book should have a really big dust jacket. And I can help you with that. I can design you a big dust jacket." This is another way things don't work. Is there a handheld microphone I should be using? He said, "Surely you'll need a big dust jacket." And I said, "Who the hell are you?" And he said, "My name's David McCauley, and I can draw some pictures for you." And this is sort of like having Leonardo da Vinci sitting next to you saying, "I can help you with the illustrations in your term paper." So I jumped on it. And we settled not on doing a big dust jacket, but instead doing the end pages for the book. And this is the smaller version of the Bhutan book. Still pretty big. I've got to tear it open. I should give this away to a lucky audience member so you can have one different piece of Macaulay in your collection, one that most people don't know about. So the dust jacket here says Bhutan, spread across the back. And we did something that I thought was kind of nice. The book is very colorful and, you know, gorgeous pictures of a kingdom that most people will never see. But David's end pages are here. And they're a little bit like a classic Victorian adventurer's map. You know, the sort of thing you want to set the tone. You put your eyes on a map like this, and it transports you to a different place. And that's exactly where you want to be as you open up the book. In fact, we went an extra step and we decided to just print the end pages right inside of the dust jacket. So in the end, David did wind up designing the dust jacket also, although he didn't know it at the time. So that's how we met. And with that, let me just turn it over to David, since I guess we've failed to find the other pictures. A shame, but off we go. You don't? Okay.
No, not there. Okay. Hi. This picture is, it may be the first image of the way things work, probably drawn around 1984, I think, by a fellow named Alan Buckingham, and it was a description of the book that they had in mind, they being Dorling Kindersley, the originators of the book, had in mind. And this little diagram was one of those diagrams that got us all excited. I was not formally a part of the project when this diagram was made, but this was their way of, they wanted to sort of group machines by families, and the DNA that linked those families was in fact the physics principles behind each of the machines in this group, but machines that did completely different things. So you get this wonderful juxtaposition and inherent humor, an opportunity to play, which is the only reason I finally agreed to get involved with the project, because it intrigued me, and I did see that there was going to be play involved in what was otherwise the daunting possibility of having to create 400 pages worth of machines. For somebody who had never made a book longer than 112 pages, and most of them were closer to 80. This just seemed like an impossible task. And honestly, to you know, having dealt with architecture, sort of big things that I really enjoyed taking apart, the notion of this many machines and machines themselves, it just didn't seem like the kind of thing that that I could, you know, get excited about and stick with for the length of time that would be necessary. Anyway, for this is one of the earliest spreads that came from this, these two simple little ones. I think this was produced for a book, the book fair in Frankfurt, to try to lure, you know, prospective publishers in. And a lot of text. The text got reduced somewhat in another version, sort of coming out of the out of DK. This begins to look like the Sears catalog for all the machines. You know, I can just imagine page after page after page of this. And I thought, this is, you know, I don't think this is going to work. So I was beginning to think about the very first section of the book, levers. How complicated could that be? Fairly straightforward. How to organize it? First class, second class, third class. Turning into rotation and the wheel and the axle and so on and so forth. So levers, I went at initially with this approach. Text is still a little heavy. The art is actually Stone Age. It's a Stone Age laundry. And they're pressing things with rocks and levers and stuff like that. And, you know, in by nine, out by five. That sign's been made for, obviously, a long, long time. Not the same sign, but different signs. And so, but I was feeling like, okay, maybe I can get into this. Maybe I can get involved and excited about this. But I'm still back on the tracing paper trying to sort of, well, really hoping that something would hit me that would make me say with real confidence that this was going to be okay. And it was at the bottom of this piece of 17 by 24 tracing paper that this little thing happened. And my cave people are still there, but for some reason I stuck a mammoth between them. And because I felt that if we were going to set this story or some kind of a narrative, you know, way back when, there should be some of the flora and fauna associated with it. So you'd get swamp grass, and if you've got swamp grass, you certainly probably have a mammoth. The next question was, okay, how to use the mammoth, not just use it as background. And so this is a sketch that obviously never made it into the book, but the idea behind it made it into the book. And I began to think about how the mammoth would get involved with these machines, particularly with levers. And in fact, the whole question of weighing a mammoth struck me as a possibility for the simplest first class lever. Get the mammoth on one end of the log, get the villagers on the other end of the log. Once the log is horizontal, you can tell what the weight of the mammoth is by simply weighing the villagers. The problem is getting the mammoth onto the end of a log. No mammoth in its right mind, and with any sort of survival instinct, is going to go along with that concept. So you have to hurt the mammoth, basically. I was reluctant to say it, but there I said it. You have to sort of make the mammoth a little less capable of defending itself. And that required building a ramp, another simple machine. One thing slowly led to another, and out of it emerged this notion of the inventor's notebook, for which I could write my own little silly stories and intentionally get some of the technical information that this image was introducing wrong, so that when Neil began to work on his technical text, he could sort of make corrections and explain what was a little off and so on and so forth. But it gave him a more playful way of getting into the heavy text, and it gave me a chance to really have some fun and be quite silly and create these fake parchment. Who doesn't like to create the look of fake parchment? I remember as a high school student making little copies of the Declaration of Independence. You know, with tea as what, I don't know how I stained the paper, but I'd go in with these little things and unfold them just to impress my friends in that kind of no man's land that they call sitting in the cafeteria waiting for the bell to ring before first period. So I was the star of that part of the day as many times as I could come up with something. So eventually, we're going to move from mammoths and just fun to actually getting some machinery in there and some weighing machines and things of that nature. This is half a spread from the original edition and half the new way things work now. We removed the mechanical typewriter from the bottom of this spread and replaced it with the pedal. So it still continues the drawing. And this got me figuring out how to use Photoshop to transform and update some of the old art and otherwise to completely recolor some of the old art. A note, an economic note about the book, the original edition was half four color, half two color, alternating spreads. The reason being, it would have been too expensive to produce the book in all full color in 1988. So to, you know, encourage people to pick it up off the shelf, we made that compromise. When I agreed to come back and do the revisions for the way things work now, I made it my I made it clear that what I really wanted to do, in addition to introducing new technology, was go back into every one of those two-color spreads, remove the color, and add new color. And the challenge, of course, was to make it feel like the old book so that when you turn the pages, it's still seamless. Now, the interesting thing about working with two-color and four-color is that in order to avoid a jarring reaction every time you move from two to four, I had to mute the color in the full-color spreads. I had to really damp it down. So this meant I was imitating damped-down color, but I had to sort of maintain that feel. And for the most part, I think we got away with it. I have a couple that I lost control of, and they're in there. But it was an interesting challenge, and it's a particularly interesting challenge for me. Now, I'm not really that big on technology, and it's probably why there's so much humor in this book. I'm just trying to cover myself and camouflage my lack of thorough understanding of much of the stuff the book presents. And if I wasn't working with really smart people, I don't think it would ever happen. It wouldn't work. There's a real team effort behind a book of this magnitude, and we were each allowed to build on our strengths. And the result was something that I think actually seems to be working well. Otherwise, we wouldn't have been producing a second revised edition after 10 years after the first revised edition. Not technically ahead of the curve, not even remotely. My version of Photoshop, for instance, which is what I used for this work, was the one that came with my scanner. You know, what is it, Elements 6 or something like that? That's all I've got. There's nothing in the cloud, nothing anywhere else. And I'm so scared that if this computer dies, that I'm going to lose Elements 6, the one I know how to use about 2% of to make this. I mean, it's a pathetic story. So I'm just trying to get your sympathy here. And obviously, there's not much to say about that. The sketches keep evolving as I keep trying to explain other things, the sequences. Here's an early attempt at the two-color spread with belts and wheels and gears and things of that nature. And it finally became this. The gears become much larger. The difference between the first one and the second one is that the actual gears that you're supposed to be talking about were too small to even notice. So I made them larger. Terrible color. This is my version now of that for the new edition. And in many cases, not only does it just add a little more life to the spread, but much more importantly, it holds on to the line work and makes sort of outlines and things clearer and easier to read, which, I mean, the whole point of this is to make this information not only fun to look at, but clear and accurate. So you can see just a couple of examples of the transformations. The car engine, this is one of the themes that ran throughout the book, everything about the car. This was Neil Ardley's, the technical guy, and I mean technical writer, critical to the success of this book, getting me started with that. And then I just began to play with it. My job, one of my jobs as the illustrator, is to use my ability to select a point of view from which to show the things we're talking about. And so you do that by not necessarily having an idea in your head to start with, although you do recognize when it's not working. And so you keep drawing. Now, I think of the car, or thought of the car then, as this hugely transformative thing. I mean, it changed everything. So I wanted to give this thing a sense of power, and it felt to me like it should be kind of hovering overhead to some extent, you know, sort of weightless and sort of magical and mysterious. This was the first attempt at the double page spread. You need angels. They were, in fact, the low bidders, so they got the job. But what you don't have here is any color or any sort of strength to it. So I reworked it before we actually went to press, and this is the final image of that thing. So it has some weight. It doesn't have that sort of looking up at quite in wonder, but the angels are still obviously busy. What happened, of course, is as I got into the spreads, I had to think more and more about the text blocks and where they fell and how to hold on to a composition from left to right, you know, upper left or lower right, whatever, a stream, a map for the reader that would take into account the demands of both the words and the pictures and ultimately the information. The combine harvester, much clearer in this illustration. This is the four color that was a two color, and it actually is easier to read, I'm happy to say. The sewing machine also has received a new treatment. The drone was not obviously in the first book, but this does illustrate another of my tendencies, which is to include little bits of nonsense. The portrait of a family of birds seen on the little screen of the controller, and you only see one little wingtip just poking around a piece of Trinity Church. And there is the drone up there, the quadcopter, as it's called in this book. It comes after the helicopter and so on, so it makes sense. Here we removed something. I can't remember which one we took out, but we actually compressed information from the right-hand page, moved it over to the left-hand page so we could hold on to it because it was all still relevant, in order to create a space for the airport scanner. You may be wondering why the White Rabbit is there from some, you know, second-rate version of Alice in Wonderland without Tenniel's art. Because I wanted the watch. I didn't want the rabbit so much, but I wanted the watch so that it would be picked up by the scanner and seen on the screen. Now, in all of those illustrations from the original edition that had the old-fashioned television, you know, the CRT television, I had to go back in and pull those out and put flat screens in. So, a thankless task, mind you, but nevertheless, somebody had to do it. A new Mars lander. Now, here's an image that actually does really benefit from the color. Here's the steel making process through the various devices and machines. When it gets color, you have a sense of heat and cool and just easier to read it. And it's more fun and it's livelier. The dot matrix printer, who doesn't love and remember the dot matrix printer? So this was one of those where the machinery, the device, lent itself to really playing with the composition. I mean, follow that tape as it takes your eye around and make sure that you're presenting the information in a way that's logical and sequential when it comes to laying out the text. This is one of the early sketches. And it's put together with magic tape. I always use the most high-tech stuff, magic tape and my photocopier, and tracing paper, and felt tip markers. And it's on cheap, really cheap tracing paper, because if I sketch on cheap tracing paper, I just go through it, you know, like sheet after sheet, pad after pad, and it doesn't matter. If I have to confront that white sheet of 4-ply Bristol drawing board too soon, I'm already scared. My hand seizes up, and inevitably, like 2 minutes into it, you've splattered it. But the secret is to just keep going. It's like putting that scratch in your new car yourself, rather than worrying about it and letting someone else have the pleasure. So light bulbs change, and video cameras, and so on and so forth. So we don't need, this is all in the book. These are the new elements, the new ideas. Digital recording, sound recording, picture recording, as in cameras, 3D printer. The car theme remains in place with the hybrid, which I almost forgot about. Happened to be at a soccer match, chatting with the father of one of my son's teammates, and I was explaining to him what I was doing, because people always ask, you know, what are you working on? And I sort of said, well, I'm doing this update for the way things work. And he said, oh, you mean things like the hybrid car? Well, that was the first He was the first person to suggest the hybrid car. We were already in, not in production exactly, but you know, half the art was done. So I had to go back to my friends in London and say, you know what, we really forgot something kind of. Anyway, it's in there for those of you. Storage devices, it's getting harder and harder to find ways of making this stuff clear. This basically, you know, what is it? An X-ray vision of a USB plug-in thing, a flash drive, and a larger drive for storage. But it's just a little city. You know, it's just a little blocks, and it doesn't really tell you what's actually going on. So, you know, it's included. I don't feel like I've made a real contribution to helping you understand how this works. And it may not be possible with this kind of imagery. It doesn't. I always believe that if I can draw something, then I understand it. So when you see that I'm drawing something in a fairly simple way, it probably means that I'm not totally in control of this information, and I don't have some insider's view, some metaphor that wouldn't be more complicated than simply explaining it in a sentence, some visual, you know, some visual metaphor. So here's your flat screen television. Wonderful to see light being sort of twisted that way to work its way through the various planes. The touch screen, little mammoth drawing there, and a little cave person drawing a mammoth in the upper left-hand corner, and just how that all happens. And for those of you who notice in the lower right-hand, bottom of the right-hand page, the fingerprint where the screen was touched, and as we hone in and locate the center of that activity, that's my fingerprint. That was fun. I mean, just, you know, slime up your finger and do it. E-paper, one of my favorite little discoveries. You know, little beach balls, the diameter of a human hair, filled with charged particles, and transparent, of course. Charged particles, black and white. And if you use the transistor on the plane beneath them to change the current from positive to negative, you will either draw the white particles down to the bottom of the beach ball, which means the black ones are going to move up to the top and become parts of letters, or it'll reverse it if the transistor turns the other way. So anyway, video controller. For those of you who play FIFA, fortunately, I have a teenage son who's been playing FIFA now for, I don't know, at least four variations of FIFA. And he used to get really frustrated when he would lose these meaningless competitions. And so he has a little bag of abused controllers. But it's great from a research point of view, because I could just say, Sander, can I have one of your things to take apart? He said, yeah, go ahead. They're all apart anyway. And anyway, that little contraption in the lower left-hand corner was one of my favorites because it's still highly mechanical in the way it moves. I mean, you have to sort of move either in this direction or in that direction, but because you're moving your thumb in a circular direction, this little contraption, which is very mechanical and visually understandable, which always pleases me, also moves, you know, moves in a circle because the materials are flexible enough and allow movement that creates this kind of circular pattern. Anyway, so the optical mouse, sometimes drawing big is really fun. You know, sometimes creating something really much larger than life, because it makes you wonder, what on earth is that? And what it turns out to be is that thing you've had your hand over most of the time and don't really think about what's going on inside it, as long as the cursor is responding in a way that you feel is appropriate. And the robot. And the web. And we're back at the beginning. So that is a quick overview of how this thing evolved and where it now is. Now, in order for me to do another version of this book, knowing full well that the technology we'll have to talk about will be even more sort of digitally based than where we are now, which is hard to imagine, but and impossible to avoid, I think the book is going to have to be more or less the size of Michael's Bhutan book, because I want to take you inside those little tiny chips. I'd like to actually be able to get in there at a scale that would allow me to show, to learn, first of all, what's actually happening by trying to draw it, and then if that works, to share it and show it. So that's that. So no more pictures. Yours may turn up yet. You just never know. Sometimes, you know. We're just going to relax, think about what's next. Do you have any questions?
I'm full of questions, but it'd be much more interesting to hear from you. And I'll repeat the questions so that everybody hears. Go ahead.
Well, I'm actually interested in Genesis, some of your early work, the cathedral pyramid. Can you talk about that a little bit?
The question was, what about the genesis of your earlier work, city, cathedral, pyramid, and so on?
Well, that's easy. I have a degree in architecture from Rhode Island School of Design, and so when I decided not to be an architect, which was about halfway through my architectural education, I needed to start thinking about alternatives. And I taught at a couple of different schools, Newton South, for a couple of years, and Central Falls Junior High School in Rhode Island. I survived the junior high school experience, barely. Middle school, I mean, oh, tough crowd. But once I started illustrating, I realized that while I could get some freelance work, I was going to want to write my own stuff. And all I really knew anything about was architecture. And because I'd studied it. And I'm glad. I've always been glad I studied it. It was a wonderful way to learn how to think. So the first book, sort of evolved from a fantasy story, which I thought was going to be a classic. Did not turn out to be a classic, but opened the door. And the image of my half-finished cathedral in one of those sample drawings that I submitted to the publisher was the thing that began the conversation. So then all I had to do was figure out, how do you really build one of these things? And it was really fun to find out. I didn't get it right in the very first edition, and recently redid Cathedral in color and reworked all those things that were kind of problematic about the original. But what it doesn't have is that striking kind of black and white pen and ink cross-hatching. That was the trade-off. I can't draw that way anymore. I mean, those drawings take a long time. But, you know, I pass this along to anybody who's, you know, an author or illustrator who wants, you know, immediate fame and fortune. Learn to cross-hatch, because people are really impressed by cross-hatching. It's amazing. It's almost like the more lines you can draw on a piece of paper, the more successful those images are going to be, even if there's no content. It doesn't really matter. Content's neither here nor there. It's just they're impressed by the look. So, they did their job. Cathedral and city and pyramid and so on. Also, what they did was give me an opportunity to really explore, to go places, to see things that I wanted to see because I wanted to see them, first of all, but realized in order to justify that, I was going to have to write a book about it. Pyramid falls into that category. I would not have written Pyramid were it not for the opportunity of making a book, I mean, of going to see them and climb them and that sort of stuff. But they were big. They're not machines exactly, but they're, you know, it's where it started, obviously. Instead of taking something that was finished in the book and sort of taking it apart or making it x-ray, I wanted to get to the beginning, to clear the site, to dig the foundation holes, and actually show you step by step how you build something if you want it to last for 800 years out of stone. And that was a tremendous challenge. It allowed me to create some dramatic images on an oversized book. A 9x12 was a pretty big book at the time. Could not have been in color. It would never have been affordable. And nobody would have taken a chance on a guy named Macaulay doing this 9x12 book that would have cost a small fortune in 1973 standards. So I'm doing the same thing. I found myself becoming this explainer of things. That's important to me because what I really am is a student of everything. And the challenge always is to jump into something that I feel very uncertain of, have often relatively little knowledge of, and learn it by drawing, mostly by sketching. The amount of material in the studio that's left over from these book projects, the detritus, is unbelievable. But that's what it is. It's the leftover layers of pieces of trace paper scraps where an idea gradually takes shape, not just for the composition of a page, but for the clarity of the information as I draw it and draw it and draw it. That's why I do these things. And the transition into the way things work, while I was sort of invited into that project, sort of flowed perfectly. And the one sort of problematic part of this whole thing was when I decided to learn about the human body. Because I, you know, at 55 and I really knew almost nothing about it, it was kind of embarrassing. And so I thought, okay, let's do it. Let's build the body. I had imagined a more kind of inventive, somewhat fantastic approach to building the human body. And it's still something that maybe one day might happen, although I don't really believe that. I just thought I should say that. But because it would require another Michael-sized book to really get in there. But it was an overwhelming challenge. And that's when I really thought, do you really want to know all this stuff? But I, you know, now I know stuff, basically. At least I know who to ask and what kind of system we're talking about when I hear certain things. So I'm really fun at cocktail parties, although not necessarily right before dinner. I'm an explainer, and every once in a while, I get to just have fun and do a shortcut or a Why the Chicken Crossed the Road or a Motel of the Mysteries. Those are books that I consider my vacation books. That's instead of actually taking a vacation. You just do a book that doesn't follow any of the same rules, doesn't have any of the same limitations, comes entirely from the imagination, except in terms of visual references, which is, of course, part of what makes Motel of the Mysteries work and totally silly.
I'm just curious, how many of you have seen or read Motel of the Mysteries? So those with your hands up will appreciate why that's a Macaulay book that I keep in my bathroom, because the big punchline in the book is to do with the ceremonial headdress.
Well, Motel of the Mysteries, just for those of you who have not seen it, basically is the discovery of a motel in 4022, but it's seen as a tomb complex by the fellow who finds it, because he still subscribes to National Geographic, and which is still in print, obviously, in 4022. And you know, he sees the seal on the door, hanging right on the knob, and he realizes this is a tomb that's undefiled. I mean, so it's recorded, photographed, sketched, and everything's numbered, including the ceremonial meal, which is still placed, outside the door, as at Lowe's Hotel nearby. So they're still performing this ritual. It's a tour. The door is finally pushed open. You have to break the chain, which is holding the door closed, and you break that, and there's the outer chamber, and there's the deceased on a platform facing the sacred altar, which is up on this kind of bureau thing. And in his hand is some kind of a device for communicating with the altar. And then there's an innermost chamber, and that's the most fantastic thing. The innermost chamber with this gleaming white sarcophagus, and next to it is the sacred urn, and attached to the sacred urn is the ceremonial collar. And around the ceremonial collar is this paper headband that would be worn during the... So you get the point, but it's drawn, it's all cross-hatched, so it looks like it was produced... It looks like it was produced in the 1880s. It's set in, as I say, 4022. It's a complete mishmash of images and styles and times and so on and so forth. Pure fun. And that book came after Great Moments in Architecture, which was my first opportunity to sort of take advantage of the reputation I was kind of building with the architecture books and just play. Just have fun. And once that little guy's out of the box, once that horse has left the stable, there's no really going back full time to being a serious guy. I mean, even in the earlier books, there are moments of nonsense. The rats in the bottom of the manhole in underground and that sort of stuff. But they're little throwaways, and they are rewards to those readers who come back and look at the book a second time or a third time, especially younger readers. It's been always impossible to keep the humor out of it, but you have to sort of get more confident. And over the years of making those books, I found myself putting a few more little things in, and that's why, Great Moments finally broke that once and for all. You have to be careful with humor. It's great, can't live without it, more so today than ever. You could also compromise the information, and the last thing I want to do is hurt the credibility of the facts, because that's part of what this is. It is a celebration of human ingenuity. These books are a celebration of human ingenuity, whether really big or really small. That's at the heart of it, and I find actually that the humor emphasizes the human touch, the human connection. So
What I find so interesting about that long answer to a short question is that you started out wanting to be an architect, make a little picture and it gets built into a building, but you went the opposite direction. You became the anti-architect, drawing pictures of things for unbuilding purposes to understand how they all go together.
Not necessarily an anti-architect, but certainly an unbuilder.
Have you ever done an actual architectural drawing, like an extension to your house or something that needs to be built? That part of your training?
I mean, I have, but we've never actually, we just look at them and then we say, you know what, let's not do this. I worked for an interior designer in the early 70s, and we did a couple of buildings, and one of them was the public toilets at a park in Providence, and we built it, and overlooking the water. And so we built it as this kind of little fortification, very inviting. And what we envisioned was, you have to do that stuff inside, but what else is it going to do? And we wanted something that you could climb on and sort of walk up to the bridge and look out at the water and let your imagination go. And that was the fun part. They destroyed it. sometime, years later, it's gone. And that's okay, really. It's not a memorable structure. It was not. But no, that's it from me. And
before we pick another question for the room, I have one other little one. When did you start scratching this itch? Were you the 10-year-old kid who was always doodling in margins and getting scolded for it, and then you sort of, against your better judgment, went to architecture school? Where did it start?
It started in England, where I grew up. My childhood was neatly wedged between my first year and my 10th year. And then we got on a ship and came to the United States, and everything was different. So my childhood was definitely in England, and we lived in the north of England. We lived in a small house with two rooms on the first floor and two rooms and a bathroom on the second floor, or something like that. And it was one of many in the row. And then there was a similar row on the other side of the street, et cetera, et cetera. As a kid, I did two things. If the weather was decent, I played outside. I just played. I didn't draw I drew a little bit, but not with any kind of intent until I was trying to get my artist merit badge in this country for Boy Scouts. But I made models of things out of cardboard and, a shoebox and thread that was at the end of the spool that my mother sewed, knitted, and all that sort of stuff. So I made things out of what was available, what was left over. But the stuff that really mattered was, I think, the time I spent outside, running around through the woods, being whoever I wanted to be, animal, human, whatever. Hoping to discover little things on my walk through the woods to school every day, which happened four times because of lunch. I remember finding a mouse skeleton or a mole. I don't know what it was now, but and that's just fantastic. I didn't realize until, last year that The Wind in the Willows is a work of fiction, because as a kid, I was in The Wind in the Willows, for much of that first 10 years. And my mother, because we're in a small house, had a little brother and a younger sister, was so happy when I volunteered to go outside and play. So it was a perfectly symbiotic relationship. It was terrific. Good relationship.
You'll get a chance to do that again in another 15 minutes. But yeah. With the time we have left, let's have some quick questions and quick answers. You and then you. So the question was, have you read Pillars of the Earth by Ken Follett? And if so, how did it influence your work? No. Next.
No, but I should, I have to follow up just briefly. Ken Follett wrote to me after Cathedral and said he'd been thinking about doing this book. And he wanted to know if I would be willing to do a little illustration for the opening of each chapter. And I was so busy with, I don't know what I was busy with. I don't know what the book was at the time. But I was always teaching full-time, and so I had to decline. So I feel connected to it, but I've never actually read it.
Sir, with the beard, yes. You can use the microphone, and then I won't repeat.
really nice to hear your talk. I'm fascinated with the idea of technological progress in the 21st century becoming too complex for, you know, the common person to understand. And in a way, I think it's a human rights issue for many people to have the right to understand what they're using every day, you know, in your mobile phone or, you know, especially with things becoming so complex that they can be used for nefarious purposes by governments or other organizations. So I want to hear your thoughts on that. And then related to that, was there something that you plan to be in the revised version of this book that was too complex or just turned out to be an intellectual property issue that you just couldn't make it into the book?
Well, as far as the first thing goes, I mean, I think it is important that we be encouraged to have some basic understanding of everything we use, so that you feel not at its, you know, at the mercy of this technology all the time. My way of contributing to that is to try to get inside them and help visualize this information. Once we had electricity in the way things work, I knew I was in trouble. I mean, so you're talking about radio waves and things of that nature and electricity, and how do you draw electricity? I mean, really, without arrows and, you know, those sort of conventional cliché devices. So it was already a disadvantage. But that doesn't mean the fight stops. It becomes even more important. Even though I can't draw it, and as I said earlier, I think when I can draw it, I feel like I understand it. And if I can draw it well enough to make it accessible to someone else, I'm hopefully giving them a little bit more understanding. But when that becomes more and more difficult, we tend increasingly to be taking devices and technology for granted, at which point we've already doomed ourselves because things can happen to it that you won't even notice because you don't remember what the first one looked like or the second one looked like, and you never knew anything about what was going on inside it. So it may be a losing fight, although I just think we use different mediums, and the book may not always be the right medium for explaining this stuff, but the fact is it's wonderfully reassuring in its old-fashionedness. And the book has always been 400 pages long, and even though we've got more stuff in it now than we ever had. And I think there's something about that size, that sense of, you know, it's sort of a romanticized notion, I suppose, but as a kid, I certainly believed that my Encyclopedia of Science for Boys and Girls had everything in it that I would ever need, from rocks to space to the tallest building in the world and so on and so forth. I sort of think of the way things work kind of in that mold, except much longer than the encyclopedia. It's a battle that's going to go on, and as long as we pay attention, that's what it comes down to. My job is to stimulate curiosity. It's not to answer all the questions and contain all the facts. It's to stimulate curiosity so that we never completely take anything for granted. As long as that's the case, I think we'll be okay.
A couple more questions. Yes, sir, in the middle. The question was, like using the hand controller from a video game as a reference model, are there other examples of sort of trinkets or things you've had to pick up to refer to?
You know, I found myself using information online a lot to do that. So, I mean, that brings up another issue. Here I am creating another old-fashioned book, and I'm using what the internet can do in terms of this extraordinary resource for video and so on and so forth. I don't take that many things apart. I sort of try to learn about it in the easiest way, but in the most accessible way. But if you want facts, the internet is the place to go. If you want pleasure, the book is the place to go. And I think we could probably stir up more curiosity, or at least as much curiosity, through page turning and built-in limits. So, no, I don't have a room full of half-destroyed things. Well, the printers, for one thing. But that's because I don't accept that technology has a right, talk about human rights, to not work. It only has to do a few things. And when it stops doing them, I have no patience with it. I don't admire it. So I have thrown a couple of printers at the wall, and they have remained there. And then I drive to Best Buy, and I get another one, and I bring it back, and, you know, I've got maybe 2 years, and I'm, you know, optimistic, eternally optimistic.
I have exactly the same trouble. When one of my pet peeves is you go to a Chinese restaurant and take the teapot and pour some tea in the cup, except it dribbles down the side of the pot and spills all over the table. The teapot has only one job in life to do.
Right.
Why can't they get it right?
That's right. You would think with all those centuries behind the teapot.
They do have, there is a dripless teapot trick. Is that in the book yet? If not,
no, the dripless teapot is one that escaped us. Probably would have been there were it not for the hybrid car.
And the hybrid car.
The hybrid teapot.
More questions from other questioners. Yes, sir. Oh, sorry. Front row.
I wonder if you could say something about your teaching. What your experience was like, what kids were like, what you discovered.
The question was, say a little something about your experience teaching.
To put it very simply, I love to teach. There's nothing more fun than teaching. I mean, there's a little bit of showing off, but more importantly, there's that sense of being in the classroom with fellow students. And they may be 17 or 18 years old, and they may be 21 or 22, and they may be older. But I'm a student. I will always be a student. It's why I do what I do. And I found a way of actually, I suppose you could say, monetizing my desire to be a student and always being in some kind of grad school program, which has to be paid for. So it's one of the most rewarding and most satisfying things, and it's nothing like seeing work being done now by some of my former students and, you know, in some cases helping them, encouraging them, and so on. I never discourage them unless I think they're really on the wrong track. But there's a level of discourse and honesty in the studio, teaching at RISD, teaching in Newton South, and so on, that was really terrific and refreshing, and it kept me always sort of grounded. I knew that I wasn't there because I had all the answers. I knew I was there because I could think a little faster, because I had more experience. But I never knew what the questions were going to be to which I was going to have to respond with some quick thinking. And that was the wonderful thing about it. It's an environment of surprise and sort of reassurance and reinforcement that I just think is the best place to be.
Are you still teaching, or are you drifting in and out of that? Or?
I'm about to start teaching a course, co-teaching a course in the engineering department at Dartmouth about drawing to see things better and to understand things by sketching. Not making beautiful art, but by being willing to pick up a pencil and scribble on something as you're speaking so that you begin to understand better what it is you're saying by the way in which you find yourself moving that drawing implement. Lipstick on a napkin, whatever it is, in an attempt to clearly explain something to someone else. I think that sketching for me is one of the best ways of encouraging people to notice the world around them. Sitting in front, one of my next projects, as soon as I get time, will be to sit in front of the telephone pole in front of our house in Vermont and figure out what on earth is going on at the top of that pole. It's got stuff all over it. And I am curious about it, but I still haven't taken the time to actually dissect it. And that means once I've dissected it and drawn it, then I have to start calling people and saying, okay, what is that? What is that big cylinder up there? What is that? I know what a fuse looks like now because it killed a squirrel fairly recently and wiped out our power for a few hours. Poor squirrel. But that's one way of learning, right? Look for the accidents and the holes in the ground and, you know, be curious, look inside.
It's interesting. If you want to see some nice, lively telephone poles, we invented telephony in Cambridge. That's where Alexander Graham Bell made his first phone call. And so some of the original poles are there. They start to lean over because they've been overburdened. And then they nail a second pole to the first pole with little joists.
Right. No, it's great.
You know, you'd be better off hiring kids who want to build a tree fort, having them replace the infrastructure. Yeah. It's just a disaster.
But that's true. There's so much stuff. That's just one example of the stuff around us that we've learn to ignore and completely depend on.
I think we have time for one more question. So, yes, right in the middle here, sir. Yes, you.
Abandoned
Mm-hmm. Question was about workflow. Do you ever start one project and then kind of hit a dead end, abandon it, and try another one?
Yeah. The book I'm working on now about the building of the SS United States, the ship that we came on, began as a book about invention. And I worked on the invention book for 2 years, and I realized I was simply replicating in book form what's already online. And it didn't need a you know, at least I couldn't see the value of my voice behind it, visually or verbally. But I did spend 2 years on it, and there are piles and piles of research material for that. So I moved into something that obviously involved technological advancement in 1950, 51, 52, but it also had a personal side, which is why I went with that. Yeah, that happens, unfortunately, a lot, and it's hard to figure out how. I talk about monetizing. That's when the meter, when you make your own electricity, solar panels and stuff, and the needle's going the wrong way. That's what's happening with those kinds of projects. The needle at the bank account is going this way, and you think, but somehow the experience always, it ends up having some value, even though it's really frustrating. You know, the last thing you want to do is stick with a book that you just don't feel deserves the paper. You have to be willing to say it, okay? I mean, I tell my students all the time, don't get overly attached to this thing because you'll do better. And if you become precious about it, you'll sort of freeze up, and that'll be the end of the learning process. Don't give up on something too soon, but also learn to recognize when it's just not worth it. We have only so much time.
And that's about as much time as we only seem to have. Let's thank David.
And thank you. Thank you.
Please, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Please spend a little time with David out by the book signing desk. And if one of you happens to want an unusual David McCauley drawing that is wrapped around this Bhutan book, come and grab me. I've only got one copy. Thanks again.